This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. According to official government estimates, military operations in Iraq now cost about $12.5 billion a month. But our guests, Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes, say those numbers don't take into account other costs spread throughout the non-military parts of the federal budget, costs that will be borne by future taxpayers, and economic damage from the war. Stiglitz and Bilmes have attempted a comprehensive accounting of the invasion's cost in a new book called The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. A little later, we'll hear from Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. But first, Linda Bilmes. She's held several senior government positions in budget and finance, and she now teaches at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She's done research on the costs and challenges of treating veterans who return from the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. She says taxpayers will pay to treat the physical and psychological wounds of Iraq veterans for decades. Well, Linda Bilmes, welcome to Fresh Air. As you've looked at how veterans of Iraq are treated, one of the issues that you write about, besides the enormous cost borne by taxpayers and the pain that their family suffers, is the limbo that wounded servicemen and women face in the bureaucratic transition from active duty to the care of the Veterans Administration. What are some of the problems that you see there?
What you have is a situation where, for the returning veteran, there is no easy way to leave the military and to get into the Veterans Department benefits area. So you have this kind of protracted, almost second war that veterans fight when they get home. Typically, a veteran is discharged from the military. If they have a disability of some form, it takes at least 6 months for them to begin receiving any kind of compensation for that disability, even if they have a very significant wound or injury. And if there is anything wrong with the settlement, the initial decision that they have, if they have to appeal it, it takes 2 years or longer for them to get get compensation. So it's an unnecessarily long process because the veteran should be able to just quickly leave the military and move sort of seamlessly into the veterans' medical and benefit program. And in fact, they have to go through a quite protracted and complicated process.
Maybe you could illustrate this with an example. I mean, in Iraq, a vet is wounded, let's say, in an explosive device that blows up in their Humvee. I mean, they may spend time at a hospital in Germany. Take us through the journey. What path do they follow?
Well, let's say that a veteran is injured in Iraq, and he is treated initially on site. He is then medevaced to Langenthal Hospital in Germany. He is then transferred back to a military hospital in the U.S., say to Walter Reed. He maybe receives rehabilitation or treatment at two or three other facilities. When he is finally ready to be discharged from the military, if he's discharged right away, he would then lose all the benefits that he has associated with being in the military, which includes pay, it includes medical care, it includes any kind of family benefits, and he would essentially have nothing. So what happens is that veteran often is sort of hanging in limbo, languishing in an outpatient facility such as the ones that were exposed in the Walter Reed series last year, while they are effectively trying to get in to the veterans benefit compensation system. Now, the burden as it's currently structured is entirely on that veteran to prove that all of the things that he says are wrong with him actually happened. So the presumption is that those things didn't happen, and the veteran has to gather all of the documentation and all of the doctor's notices and all of the hospital forms and all of the things from all the different places, which can often take a very long time. And the system is not electronic, so you're talking about essentially a paper-based system. And for someone who comes out of a long tour of duty and an injury and often has at least some measure of post-traumatic stress disorder or at least mental disorientation, that's a very, very tall order. And it's completely unnecessary because what happens in Britain, for example, in New Zealand, in Australia, in Canada, is that the presumption is that the veteran is entitled to these benefits and the government has to prove why not. Here in the U.S., we have that sort of policy for taxes, for example. The IRS takes your tax form and then they just audit a small subset. They don't make you do all the paperwork, as it were, up front. They accept your taxes and they assume that your taxes are honest, and they audit only a subset. And what we have proposed is that we should do this for veterans. The presumption should be that what the veteran says is wrong on the basis of a medical examination when they exit.
Right.
And a subset should be audited to weed out fraud.
And when a veteran is applying for veterans benefits, suffering from whatever physical, emotional, or mental difficulties they may be that may be lingering from their combat tour, they have to rely on the Defense Department to provide information, and I gather they aren't – that sometimes they get things wrong, actually pursue people for debts they don't owe, things like that?
The military treats all people who exit the military in exactly the same way. So if you are a newly discharged soldier who has lost both legs, you get treated the same way as someone who is retiring at the end of a career. You go through the same process on exit. And as they are well aware in the Pentagon, this is a kind of non-starter for the people who are injured and they are trying to overhaul the system. But right now, the system doesn't speak, doesn't connect, doesn't work seamlessly with the Veterans Department, and it doesn't provide quickly enough for many of the veterans with injuries and disabilities all the paperwork and the materials that they need in order to very quickly receive the treatment they need on the outside.
Now, one of the features of this war, because battlefield medical treatment is so much better than it has been in years past, is that far more people survive battlefield injuries. So you have a larger stream of injured veterans coming in. And a Veterans Administration that I gather didn't exactly plan for an explosion in demand. What are some of the strains that are being placed on the Veterans Administration from physical and mental disabilities that arise from this war?
Well, the Department of Veterans Affairs has a huge capacity problem, both on the healthcare side and on the disability claims side. Now, on the healthcare side, they simply had not anticipated the huge number of troops who would be returning and seeking care. They expect that over 300,000 returning troops will be going to seek medical care from VA facilities next year. Which is about three times as many as they had anticipated. And within that, there is a particular shortage of mental health care facilities. Of the 1,400 VA medical facilities in the country, only 27 have specific post-traumatic stress disorder treatment clinics, even though we've already had over 50,000 troops come home with PTSD, diagnosed with PTSD, and over 100,000 with other mental health conditions diagnosed by the VA. So there's a real problem for just in terms of the supply of services, and this is particularly true in rural areas, in areas where the VA is just having difficulty hiring sufficient numbers of mental health professionals. On the claims side, because the Veterans Department does two things. It provides health care and it gives out disability compensation. On the claims side, there is an enormous backlog, more than 400,000 pending claims that are backed up. And the process is that a veteran has to apply to one of 57 different regional offices around the country. Some of them have claims backlogs that are going back to a year and a half long, and
put that some context on. This is like a claim for a particular a drug that they need or
no? This is if a soldier is injured in the war, when they come home after they put together their whole paperwork application, they may submit a claim for some form of financial compensation for the various medical problems that they suffer to compensate them for the fact that they can't do the job that they would have been able to do before. So let's say someone has no use for their has lost the use of their left leg, that they are now hard of hearing, and that they're vision impaired, for example. They have three problems. So And on average, a claim would cite five different problems that someone has coming home. So that claim then goes to one of these VA offices where it goes through a protracted series of analysis. They, within the Veterans Benefits Administration, will ask the veteran for additional supplementary paperwork to prove that these various problems are indeed true. And they will, at the end of it, tell the veteran that they are entitled to receive a certain amount of benefit payment. And that will be the – which comes in the form of a percentage disabled. So they would say, for example, that this person was, say, 20% disabled. And that corresponds to a monthly stipend that the veteran would receive in compensation.
And that's the kind of claim that, that there's a backlog of 400,000 of those.
Now, there's a backlog of 400,000 initial claims plus another 200,000 that are in the middle of being adjudicated. So a total backlog of 600,000. And as I said, you know, our solution to this is that all of the claims should simply be approved up front and then a subset should be audited. Because what happens now is that we put all the veterans through all of this trouble and then in the end 90% of the claims get approved anyway.
You write in the book that post-traumatic stress disorder is particularly prevalent, it seems, among vets returning from Iraq. And the mental health systems are really unable to cope with the number of vets that need care for this. What are the consequences of the failure to treat the mental disorders that vets are coming back with?
There are very significant long-term consequences, which include initially homelessness, domestic abuse, alcoholism, substance abuse, and various social problems that happen to a veteran whose post-traumatic stress disorder is not treated. Over the long term, studies of Vietnam veterans have shown that these veterans also suffer far more physical ailments, higher levels of diabetes, of heart conditions, and other long-term chronic health problems.
Your book is in part an accounting of the true costs of this war. What are all of these disorders and problems that are that go untreated or poorly treated costing taxpayers? How do you figure that out?
Well, you know, we didn't include all of the costs. I mean, for example, we did not include the cost of treating homelessness and substance abuse and domestic violence and other problems of untreated PTSD. But we just counted what it would cost to provide medical care to veterans who came back and to provide disability benefits to those who came back. And if you just look at the cost of providing disability compensation and medical care to veterans, even if we withdrew from Iraq tomorrow, even if we were not there at all, it already would double the total cost of the war. It would already be another $600 billion over the lifetime of the veterans that we would need to pay. And these are not optional. I mean, this is a these are long-term accrued liabilities. These are promissory notes. It's the kind of thing that on any sort of a business financial statement would be stated as an accrued liability.
And it is found in the budget all over the place, right, through Medicaid, through Social Security, through state and local government mental health costs?
Well, our – I mean, the cost that, that I am citing, the $600 billion in disability and medical care, that's cost primarily to the Department of Veterans Affairs and a small amount of that to the Social Security Department. Social Security disability compensation is payable to veterans who can no longer work, which would include some of the severely disabled and those with severe mental distress.
As you've looked at this problem, is there a case of a particular veteran that you think captures the tragedy of this?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I've had hundreds of veterans and their families write to me over the past 2 years that I've been working on this study. And for example, the aunt of a veteran wrote to me a couple of years ago, and her nephew was in Texas. He had been he was 20 years old. He had been injured, severely injured in Iraq. He had been treated in several hospitals. He ended up at Walter Reed, where he was awarded a Purple Heart. He was visited by President Bush and a number of generals. It took him a year in the hospital to recover from very serious injuries. After that, when his aunt wrote to me, it was 18 months later, and he still had not received a penny of disability benefits, even though he could no longer even think about working as a garage mechanic, which is what he had done before. And he also was hoping to be able to retrain as a to do something in the culinary world so he could have a part-time culinary job. And he was supposed to be eligible for benefits from the Veterans Department for that, but he hadn't received any of that as well. And by the time that this story reached me, this poor kid had been trying for 18 months. They had been phoning every day. They had been writing letters. They had spoken to their congressman, and he still did not have a penny. So the mother, who had three other kids, had taken a second job, a second shift at McDonald's in their little town in Texas in order to support her son. And this story, when it came to me, and we actually told some veterans organizations about it, and he was immediately then given 18 months of retroactive pay. But why should a veteran like this, who's already been through a huge amount of trauma, and his family have to be put through this?
You end the book with some recommendations for change. What should the government do to improve the system?
There are a number of things that the government can do, particularly to improve the situation for veterans. And one of the tragedies of this is that this is not rocket science. If you spent, or any of your listeners, spent 4 hours studying the veterans' situation, you could easily find ways to make it much, much better. First of all, veterans should be automatically enrolled in the Veterans Department system when they are discharged from the military. Right now, they have to go through a long rigmarole just to be enrolled, and enrollment should be automatic. Secondly, the presumption should be shifted so that we presume that anything that a medical doctor notes at an exit medical examination is presumed to have happened to the veteran during their service. They shouldn't have to prove that the injury to their leg or the injury to their brain happened in Ramadi. It should be presumed to go with the veteran. And third of all, there should be a number of changes to enable veterans to take advantage of educational and vocational benefits to re-enter society. Right now, veterans, soldiers, when they sign up, have to pay $1,000 up front in order to qualify ever in their lives for any kind of educational benefits from the military. There's no reason why we should be charging them that money. For a lot of young 18-year-olds who sign up, that's just too much, and so they completely forfeit their chance to ever take any educational courses when they get out because they don't have the money when they sign up. There are some very basic things that we could do that would make life much, much better for those who have served their country.
Well, you just said that anyone who spent 4 hours looking at this could come up with some simple steps that would make things a lot better. And given that, you know, everybody in Washington shares respect for the sacrifice of veterans and honors them so, it would seem that this would readily have been done by now. Why is it still so flawed?
Well, the question of why it has been flawed is one of the, you know, why has more not done been done for the veterans? You know, I would say that there is an attitude which was epitomized by a statement that Defense Undersecretary David Chu made to the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago, that the money that we're spending on the veterans essentially is money that's subtracted from money that's being spent on the defense readiness and preparedness, as if it's a kind of an either-or competition. There simply has not been a sense that the veterans deserve as much money and attention being spent on them as the troops do in the field. So I think there needs to be a cultural shift in the way the military thinks about its veterans. And there also needs to be a cultural shift in the Veterans Department away from thinking about it in terms of making sure that a veteran doesn't get one penny that he's not entitled to, toward a culture that tries to figure out how best to help the veterans when they come back. And that's simply that cultural shift has not taken place in the government to date.
Well, Linda Bilmes, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Linda Bilmes teaches at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and is co-author of The $3 Trillion War: The True Cost of the Conflict in Iraq.